Hey everybody, it's John. Welcome back to another episode of Talk to Me in the Car, a podcast about all things teaching related and education inspired that I literally record right here in my vehicle on my drive back from work as a high school instructional coach. Today we're talking all about sarcasm and its use and its misuse in our classrooms and in our written speech, and the benefits and strengths of it, as well as its potential for pain and drawbacks. We'll get to that in a second. First things first, though, some housekeeping items. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to mash that subscribe button or give us a nice rating there on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. I appreciate it. It helps people find the show. I hope you like it. And each week we do an 11-minute show. It comes out every Monday, but there's a lot more content on my website. Feel free to check that out, too. It's www.adrenalinerush.com. That's adrenaline with an E, like educational adrenaline. And it's the name of my book, Adrenaline Rush, Game-Changing Student Engagement, inspired by theme parks, mud runs, and escape rooms. So feel free to check that out on the web or anywhere books are sold. Enough about that, though. I want to talk about sarcasm today. And if you like what you're hearing, feel free to follow me on Twitter. I'm at MeehanEDU, so we can continue this conversation all week long. The goal is to take about 11 minutes this week and just sort of brain dump about this topic. And every Monday we talk about is the same format, like one topic a week while we're in the traffic, just brainstorming and ways that we can kind of unpack that over the course of the next couple days of our teaching. As you start a new school year, I think sarcasm is a big talking point. And I got to speak from my own experience. That's all I really can never speak from, right? I think that's Patrick Henry. I have but one lamp to guide my open feet, and that is the lamp of experience, the light of experience. Like, here's what I know. I was raised in New Jersey, and that's probably all you need to know about me. I'm a loudmouth kid who's happy to talk, and I was not particularly good at team sports, so I grew up, in order to fit in or in order to stand out, you'd either develop big muscles or a big mouth, and I was definitely the latter. So once the internet showed up, I would spend hours on internet forums, just like talking about anything, about sports, about movies, about TV shows, you name it, and like back and forth and back and forth, and like getting really good at sharpening your knives at people. When I was in high school, my mom said that, you know, I was in high school theater, and I hung out with the theater kids, and of course, they're really, really sharp, really, really quick. They're always trying to do a bit or some sort of improv-y thing where they're just kind of one-upping each other. She's like, John, I love you dearly, but when you're around your friends, I can't be around you because those knives are just so sharp. Like, it's not fun to see you guys go because it gets really hurtful. It's like, ah, Mom, we're just joking around. But I think this is really important because it bleeds over in our teaching practice. And in my early teaching career, it was absolutely something that I was, guilty of, I guess, right? And I told myself, and again and again, I hear people say it, oh, like, I'm sassy, I'm funny, I'm sarcastic, the kids love it, you know, they know it's good, they know I'm joking, it's how it's my love language and all that stuff. And in my home life, that may be true. I joke with my wife, like, my love language, I think, is messing with you. So, like, if you're asleep, I'll, like, hit you with a pillow. Like, that to me is a way of saying, hey, I'm here for you, but I'm going to be, you know, like a bit of a jerk. Just kind of fooling around, right? I'll text my brother something out of nowhere just to mess with him, right? You know, like, hey, how you doing? Oh, and by the way, here's a one-liner, you know just to keep us all humble. And I think we're all in on the joke, so it makes it funny. But a few years back, I was at a conference, and a teacher said about sarcasm, they said, it was a bunch of English teachers sitting in a circle, and I'll never forget it. The teacher said, you know, the word sarcasm actually comes from the Greek sarcasm, you know, whatever, sarcasmos or sarcasm. And it literally means to tear flesh, to bite the lip, or to sneer. That phrase that stood out to me is to tear flesh. And I was like, whoa. That's not a thing that I would like to ever feel on my own person. And thinking about when you use sarcasm in the classroom, you know, the kid who you're picking on or the person you're addressing your sarcasm to is usually, like, you know, chuckling and laughing. And the kids around them, of course, are having a hoot with it. Like, oh, man, you're going on them now, right? Like, ha, ha, ha. But what somebody said is, and I don't think it's absolutely 100% true. Again, these are all tendencies. They're not hard and fast rules. But what they said was, if the kids around someone is laughing when they are picked on, you know why they're laughing? On some level, it's not because they're enjoying the joke. It's because they are afraid that if they do not laugh, they will be the next one to receive the insult. And I was like, whoa. Like, that's a painful thing to think about. Talk about establishing a classroom that feels safe and supported, right? Doing the Maslow stuff before the bloom. I use sarcasm as a love language among friends and relatives and, like, you know, my own family all the time. I'm from New Jersey. We exclusively speak in sarcasm. If you ever watch, like, you know, a TV show like Friends, right? They're all New Yorkers. That's how they talk. They're constantly, you know, zinging each other back and forth and back and forth. Chandler is a perfect example of that, right? Could I be any more Chandler? Using those moments of irony or contempt or understatement or overstatement to kind of make a joke, right? But the second you turn those jokes on one another, Friends, when you actually watch it back with a critical lens in like 2019, it's actually, there's a lot of problems with a lot of the stuff that they're doing in that show. Not to mention like the casual homophobia and a little bit of, you know, racism and a little bit of body shaming and a lot of sexism and some really toxic relationships. Like, it's all, we're all in on the joke. It's all good and fun. But the way that humor works is you have to be inside of the bubble in order to understand what norms are being flouted or what conversational, like, trends are being bucked. And I think about that because for an outsider to a world of that humor, or now looking at this 15, 20 year removed from it, we have a different, you know, sociological context. And the world that we live in looks different from the bubble in which that, you know, comedy was achieved and perceived and created. And it becomes problematic with an outsider's eye to see somebody making a joke about, oh, Chandler, what are you, gay? And it's like, whoa. That's not a joke that would be funny. And so what if he was, right? Or like Chandler's mother marries her father, and her father becomes like a lead dancer in a burlesque show. He's LGBT. And all these jokes are about, like, at his expense, about, like, the misunderstanding about dad wearing a dress, or like, yeah, my dad's a freak and a weirdo. And it's, like, all played for laughs. And because it's a comedy show, we already are making some immediate consent when we watch that show. Like, if we know it is a comedy show, then we expect certain jokes to kind of come with the territory. And if we don't like those sorts of jokes, then we stop watching the show. But the difference in the classroom is when you use those sorts of jokes, your kids can't change the channel. They can't just say, I'm out for this. They're stuck in your captive audience, whether it's for 40 minutes, an hour and a half. And so they have to just sort of sit there and endure whatever you're kind of throwing at them or lobbing at them. And then you talk about, you know, that Maslow stuff. If someone doesn't feel safe and supported, no learning can transpire. So their brain centers are like constantly on high alert. And that fight or flight is kicking in about, like, will I be next to be picked on? And it doesn't have to be about sexuality. It doesn't have to be about gender or about body shaming. It could be about just other small things, like these seemingly innocuous things designed just to kind of, you know, add a little bit of levity or light in the room. Like, oh man, great call, Billy. No, man, what does Billy know? Am I right? Everyone kind of laughs at Billy. You're like, there are no wrong answers. There are no wrong questions. And then kid raises their hand and then volunteers and answers totally wrong. Like, except for that one. Peter, that was totally wrong. And we can all kind of laugh at it because we know there's a good-natured intent behind that. But you don't know what anybody's trauma looks like. You don't know what anybody's triggers look like. And to that kid who finally hazarded a guess, maybe in that moment being shot down in such a spectacular fashion is a real danger. I saw this in my own teaching when every year I try to give surveys pretty regularly. But I gave anonymous surveys, I think at the end of, I want to say maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And I had a student, and I think I know who it was based on the nature of some of the other responses, but they said that, you know, sometimes the jokes in class can hurt, and they said, you don't know it, but it feels like you're ganging up on the person who's being picked on, and the other students in class feel like they're part of a club or part of the team, but together, when you all make jokes, or one person makes jokes and the other ones don't, you know, check those things, or they go unchecked, it feels like bullying. And that's wild because, like, in my own life, I was on the receiving end of a lot of bullying. I mean, like I said, I was a small kid with, like, you either get big muscles or a big mouth. And I was a big mouth kid. So I got a lot of people who could dish it out at me. And I would give it right back as best as I could and attempt to defend myself, right? But I think about that. I know firsthand what it feels like to be on the receiving end of bullying in high school, right? You know, like seeing people who are picking on you because you were the small kid or the scrawny kid or not good at sports or, you know, whatever it looked like. And eventually, you have two choices, either ignore it or say something. And if you ignore it, it feels like it only makes it worse because they're just pummeling you every single day. So, like, you finally say something, and over time, you realize that just makes it much, much worse too. But in the classroom, I see that as well because I see so many teachers as an instructional coach who I work with who attempt to diffuse situations by using sarcasm. And then afterwards, they'll say, oh, the kids know I'm sassy. They know. It's just who I am. Or, like, they'll go on social media and say things like, you know, the kids say the darndest things kind of approaches. You might have seen it on Twitter or on Facebook, where people just kind of go off on their kids. And they don't use names, so there's obviously no there's no immediate intent to harm. But even in that presentation, there's a certain level of, like, head-shaking contempt. And it becomes like a digital faculty lounge, where we get together and put ourselves in a space where we sit in these ivory towers, right? And we send some levels of judgment or, like, you know, dismay at the foolish actions of these plebeians that we were expected to serve every day. As if, I can't believe they would do that. And here's the stupid things that they would do. And let me just say the stupid thing. And I think what that does is, like, you know, action follows being. At a certain point, we see that kids are stupid or kids are foolish or kids are prone to make mistakes. And so we find ourselves on the lookout for ways to spot those things and to kind of perpetuate those narratives. And like I said, we're all guilty of this in small degrees. It's not like I'm any better than it. But when it became a point of awareness for me that sarcasm in the classroom really can tear kids apart, my goal was never to do that, certainly, right? My goal was always to use my classroom to make students feel safe, supported, that they could take risks, that they could venture guesses, that they could fail forward. And if in attempting to treat them like friends or family, I'm using a love language that is that, I have to recognize that students in my classroom are not my friends, they're not my family, and I'm expected, I'm called to love them, but to love them in a different way. Over time, we can grow together, and then after they graduate, you know, we can catch up for a cup of coffee, or, you know, years later, for a drink at a reunion or a reception down the line, and we can share a few laughs and tell a few jokes and maybe be self-deprecating, and I think self-deprecating is very, very safe. But the second you take that and put it towards anyone else, particularly in the classroom environment, especially when you have young kids, they don't recognize sometimes the intent behind it. And even if they do, it doesn't change the fact that it really can hurt. So being mindful in all things of our tone, the way we present ourselves, and certainly in the way that we help our students feel, like I said, that our classrooms are places for them, not for us to kind of score points at their expense. So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Each week, something else, but this week is done for now. If you like what you're hearing, feel free to subscribe on iTunes. We'll be back next week for more. Thanks again.